This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to private banking service now for your business.
It's Monday, the 2nd of June. This is your BizNews briefing. I'm Bronwyn Nielsen. We have confirmation that the second group of Afrikaners touched down in the US late last week, and this time without any fanfare.
I can confirm now for independent sources that the second group of South African refugees seeking resettlement in the United States has successfully, safely landed in the United States and now flown on to their onward destinations, and confirm at least a group has arrived in one state, which I will not disclose. More information will come as we get information from these folks. If they're willing to have a conversation about their experience, I will offer it. If they want to hide their identity, I'm willing to do so for anonymity. But if they don't want to talk, then I'll leave these people in peace. But I just want to confirm today, the 30th of May, 2025, we can now confirm the second batch of refugees seeking resettlement has arrived in the United States and is either already at their ultimate destination or en route to their destinations around the United States in the contiguous lower 48. Thank you for your time and Godspeed to those arrived and welcome to America. I think you'll like it. Cheers.
Neil DeBeer sits down every Sunday with BizNews' Chris Steyn for a heart-to-heart. Here's his opinion on the second group of Afrikaners in the U.S.
And the second group of Afrikaners has arrived in America.
Yeah, without fanfare, without pictures, without suitcases. And that boggled my mind, because we're using that word a lot, is that at the end of the day, the people are going to leave if they want to leave, and the people are going to stay who want to stay. Why was there no fanfare about the second, and now I heard the third group is approved? It's because mission was accomplished day one. I think there was a little bit of naughtiness from the American government that leaked it so that they could get the first group under Donald's invitation on camera. That now happened, and they went with massive fanfare. We had each one of them now nitpicked it. This guy wasn't a farmer, he was a mechanic, and this guy there. And now, one by one, Chris, the people that are not feeling that they are safe, that they don't have a future, are now going without fanfare. And that is still, in my humble opinion, the saddest migration that this country has seen in such a long time. Because I will put all of that at the door of the African National Congress's way of treating their own citizens, and Chris, not just white, not just black, colored, or Indian, but generally South Africans in this country.
Alex spoke to Davi Root, chief economist at the Efficient Group, after Cyril spoke last week of efforts to double down on black economic empowerment initiatives in South Africa.
Maybe what we need to do, put politicians through economics 101 class and force them to understand what is going on, because the damage that's been caused by the ANC government to South Africa cannot be measured. And it's all over the economy. That's my job. I look at the local authorities. I look at the state-owned enterprise. I look at the finances of the state. You and I, we've discussed that. And I can see we've got people here that do not know what to do, people that do not have the necessary competency in order to run many of these institutions. And now they want to put the wrong policies in place. Well, they have the wrong policies. They will continue on this. They want to double down on these kind of policies. And the economy is not growing, as we all know. So are we suddenly going to see stronger economic growth because they want to have more BEE, or their view of what BEE should be? It's going to lead to an even bigger disaster. We've got the levels of unemployment. We know what it is. And so we've got children dying of hunger in South Africa because of these stupidity or these stupid policies that we have. We've got to make a U-turn here. We have to understand it's the private sector that's going to drive this economy, and the private sector that are well-skilled, and a private sector that operate in a friendly environment, and a private sector that's got access to the most recent technology.
Recently on Power Talk, host Dr. Mbuyiseni Ndlozi sat down with former South African President Thabo Mbeki. That was in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. Here's an excerpt of Mbeki unpacking the relationship between South Africa and the United States.
Now, when Marco Rubio says, we will pursue our own national interests as every other country does in a multipolar situation. That's what he means. We will define what is in the interest of the United States. They may decide tomorrow that Power FM is owned by the United States and it's in the national interest of the U.S. Mm. He'll take that decision and then act to make sure that that happens. And that's what's happening with regard to the rest of the world. They take a particular position. What is in the interest of the United States? That is the only principle that guides us in our foreign international relations. Nothing to do with multilateral or nothing like that. What is in the interest of the United States? Which will be decided exclusively by the United States. And if the United States decides tomorrow that Thabo Mbeki must die in the national interest, they will act on it. So now, then they will take a position. Here is South Africa. It's in the national interest of the United States, their view. The defense of Israel must happen. And the disempowerment of the Palestinians, even to the point of their eviction from Gaza and the West Bank and so on, in the national interest of the United States. Now, if you then pop up from somewhere and try and oppose Israel, you are acting against the national interest of the United States. They take a particular posture, as you know, towards Iran. Iran shall never have nuclear weapons, and therefore we are going to tie them to a particular arrangement. And you have seen that there's an accusation that South Africa has been bribed by Iran. So personally, I was puzzled by that. Is what does it mean? Until I came to understand that what they are arguing is when South Africa says we support the Palestinian people, that's what they say. We actually mean we're supporting Hamas, not the Palestinian people, Hamas. And because we're supporting Hamas, given the relationship between Hamas and Iran, therefore, we're on the side of Iran. And the reason we've taken up the Israeli issue in the way that we've done in the International Court of Justice is because we're bribed by Iran in support of Hamas. So that's where the argument comes from of bribery. South Africa was bribed by Iran. But we're saying the posture explained by Marco Rubio. In the context of a multipolar world, the United States will pursue its own national interest as defined by the United States. So they decide it's a national interest of the United States to have Canada as one of their states.
Yes.
The Panama Canal must be reowned by the Americans or Greenland. It's in the national interest of the United States as defined by the United States. I'm saying that impacts on everybody. That was impact on South Africa. I think if we don't understand that, the posture of the United States, and then to be able to respond to it, whatever posture they assume towards South Africa in their national interest, we must be able to stand up to say our own interest is the following. And defend whatever is in our interest and to debate with them. And perhaps you can persuade them to change what their view is about South Africa. But that's what informs the behavior, not towards only South Africa, but globally, is the pursuit of the national interest, exclusively the pursuit of the interest of the United States, not guided by anything else. If you say to them, no, but you should incorporate in your policy posture, the concept and the practice of multilateralism. No. What is that? Only if multilateralism is in the interest of the United States. If not, no. That's how Marco Rubio, when I read that interview, I understood what Make America Great means. We will pursue American interest and use whatever power we have, whether it's financial or military or whatever, to ensure that the American interest is served.
At SunExchange, we make going solar simple, profitable, and completely risk-free. Join over 100 satisfied South African customers already enjoying the benefits of risk-free solar. Start saving today. Visit sunexchange.com and join the solar revolution.
On the international front, Ukraine staged a dramatic series of strikes across Russia, deploying drones hidden in trucks deep inside the country to hit strategic airfields as far away as eastern Siberia. Bloomberg's Michael Heath shares what we know so far.
I mentioned earlier Ukraine staging a series of strikes reaching deep into Russia, Moscow launching a heavy attack of its own on Kyiv. This latest escalation coming ahead of a second round of peace talks scheduled for Monday in Istanbul. For more, let's bring in Bloomberg's Michael Heath. So even with these peace talks scheduled, it sort of really intensified business as usual when it comes to fighting on the front.
Yeah, I mean, but these were some extraordinarily audacious attacks by Ukraine. I mean, according to our reporting, they've moved these drones around in wooden houses inside Russia, and they've had drone operators there. I mean, they went into Siberia to attack airfields, you know, Tu-95 bombers, which transport nuclear weapons. You know, it's part of Russia's nuclear fleet sort of thing. Not that there were nuclear weapons on them, obviously, but that's sort of their strike capability. And President Zelensky, Ukraine's president, said that this had been more than 18 months in the making. So amazing attacks, and Russia has obviously responded with fury with the attacks that you've mentioned there. So, I mean, I'm not sure if it makes a lot of difference at this stage for the peace talks, but it just gives no sense of any let up on the front lines. And Ukraine really, it just seems to be trying to find that pain threshold for Russia, but it's very difficult to find. I mean, sort of on one hand, these attacks show that, you know, it's sort of the corruption of the Russian state that you can get so, you know, your security officials through to stage this kind of attack. But at the same time, Russia just has such, I mean, the administration there has such great control in terms of media, in terms of the message that comes out. It acknowledged that these attacks happened. It said that, you know, the damage was limited, etc. And it's obviously responded really heavily with Ukraine.
Mm. Mike, the first time that they met in Turkey back in May, we actually saw them with an agreement to exchange prisoners, also to try to get to a ceasefire. What are we expecting from this second round?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, Ukraine sort of put a lot on the agenda that its defence minister will be there and, you know, talks about a truce and all these sorts of things. But even if we go back to that first round of talks, you know, they were releasing prisoners to one another as Russia was launching really significant strikes on Kyiv as well. So I guess, you know, we've sort of just got this two-track thing of sort of trying to find a way to end the war, but neither side is going to give any ground, you know, or show any weakness, at least on the battlefield. And Russia certainly is trying to project its overwhelming strength there. So Ukraine has put a lot on the agenda. Really, what it comes down to is what Russia, you know, how interested Russia is in any of this. And for that, we're just going to have to sort of wait and see. I mean, there were a lot of hopes, or you know, fairly high hopes as well, with that first round, because President Trump had sort of sought to put a lot of pressure on both sides. Now, you know, we've got them striking each other hard, but we do have some talks between officials that will go ahead, and we really just have to see. I mean, ideally, I think what Ukraine would want, and certainly what Washington would want, is some sort of truce, some sort of ceasefire that allows them to then get to a stage where they try and work out how to end this war.
President Trump is set to double tariffs to 50% on steel and aluminium imports. Bloomberg's Shakil Omari explains how this connects to U.S. Steel Nippon Steel deal and why some are against the agreement.
President Trump doubling tariffs on imported steel and aluminium to 50%, saying this would protect American steel workers.
We're going to bring it from 25% to 50%, the tariffs on steel into the United States of America. Nobody's going to get around that.
In a statement, the United Steelworkers Union, representing nearly a million workers, said the tariffs will be a, quote, devastating blow to Canada's industries. President Trump's tariff decision comes after announcing the U.S.-Nippon Steel deal, a $14 billion investment, which the White House says $2.2 billion will be allocated to increase steel production at the Mon Valley Works plant in Pennsylvania. The White House says it will create at least 70,000 jobs. Speaking to steel workers in West Mifflin, just outside Pittsburgh, the president promising U.S. steel workers will receive a $5,000 bonus. However, opponents of the deal say they fear Japanese ownership will slash jobs and cut steel manufacturing.
And President Trump promising U.S. Steel would not announce any layoffs or outsourcing in Pennsylvania. Shaquille Omari, Bloomberg News.
That's the end of today's BizNews Briefing. We'll be back tomorrow with more context, both local and global. Thanks, as always, for watching.
This BizNews Briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to finance solutions that enable real growth.